Hey, everybody. David from the Lorehounds here. A quick note about this podcast. This is a re-release from the Properly Howard Movie Review feed, which is one of our affiliates. Back in August 2021, Steve and Anthony invited myself, John, and Alicia over to talk about the Denis Villeneuve version of the Dune movie, which is now Dune Part 1. Dune Part 2 is just releasing in the theaters now, and we thought it might be fun to re-release this conversation to help set the stage for the movie if you're planning on seeing it. And if you're planning on seeing it, we're definitely going to do some coverage for Dune Part 2. We're going to make our plans and call some lorehounds together and probably have a group discussion about it. And be sure to check out the Wool Shift Dust podcast, where Alicia is going to be continuing her coverage of the history of Dune. Everything from the books through all the various adaptations and video games and other contextual material. So stick around for all of that great material and coverage. And right after this short commercial break, we'll get into the episode with Steve, Anthony, Alicia, and I from the Properly Howard Movie Review podcast.
Uh-oh, the holidays are really coming up fast, aren't they? But to quote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, don't panic. Uncommon Goods has you covered, giving you access to thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can browse stress-free from the comfort of your own couch. And if Hitchhiker's Guide fans want to follow that book's other most important piece of advice, but find that you do not in fact know where your towel is, Uncommon Goods can help you out there too. From a wearable toga towel to a beach towel that doubles as a backgammon board, complete with oversized wooden playing pieces. Hello, my name is Alicia, and I am addicted to Uncommon Goods. I honestly can't think of another site that has something for everyone in my family, from my sports-loving dad to my foodie mom to my sister, the board game fan. Whatever you choose will feel special, personal, high quality. It will be something your recipients keep, something that makes them feel seen. Uncommon Goods likes to stock products from independent craftsmen or small businesses, which are often handmade or in the U.S., so you can feel good about where your money's going, especially since with every purchase you make, Uncommon Goods will give $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. And bonus, we can help you score a 15% discount. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/lorehounds. That's uncommongoods.com/lorehounds for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
What about your prime?
What about my prime, Nick?
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at the remake of Dune. What many considered an unfilmable novel thanks to David Lynch's initial attempt, Dune is a story of political intrigue, prophecy, sandworms, and space meth. With me to discuss this, as always, is Dr. Anthony LaDon. But this week, we are also joined by some very special Dune-loving guests.
Yeah, Alicia is joining us from Wool Shift Dust, and John and David from the Lorehounds are with us. And if you want to skip all the nonsense, we actually start talking about the film at about minute 12. You know, you're going to miss us talking about G.I. Joe a bit, but choose your own adventure.
Were you able to collect any data to see who just tunes in for the nonsense and actually stops at minute 12?
I'm assuming that most people actually stop the podcast when we actually start talking about the films.
Gotcha.
Because who's watching these films?
Well, we barely are.
I mean, I don't know how many people watch White Man Can't Jump, but it can't be a lot. I mean, think about the Venn diagram between the people that are listening to us do whatever we do, which are people in their 70s, I would imagine, and then people watching a Jack Harlow Hulu joint.
Yeah, these are folks that don't know how to get their streaming service to work. Mm-hmm.
Again, just to remind everyone that whatever professional podcasting looks like, it's not this. So we're asking you to chime in at what, is it 1 a.m. or something?
It's 1 a.m. Yeah, that's fine. I'm used to it.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sorry we couldn't do better for you. I think we do have three time zones represented. Anything you guys want to chat about before we get going? Any questions about the format of the podcast?
I did want clarification on the last one. What was it? It was like half done or better luck next
time. Oh, yeah.
Half the battle, one to grow on. Yeah. This is sort of an homage to 80s cartoons. A lot of times what these cartoons would do.
So it's like a lesson they should learn?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Is there a moral to the story?
Is there?
Okay.
So it's a moral to the story. Yeah, half the battle.
So a moral to the story in terms of like filmmaking or in terms of like the actual story?
Sort of depending on how much spice you've had prior to answering the question. Steve, correct me on this. Was G.I. Joe was sort of like, tell you about something you should probably know, and then they would say, knowing has half the battle.
That's right.
Yeah. Correct. It would be like, hey, don't pet the dog that's growling. Well, now I know.
Hi, doggy. Nice doggy. Here, boy. Come on. Hi, fella. Hey.
Don't run.
What?
Walk away slowly.
He tried to bite me.
Never try to pet an animal you don't know. He may be lost, sick, or scared.
You mean he might be dangerous?
That's right. If we don't know, we leave him alone.
And we don't get bit. Now I know.
And no one is half the battle.
G.I. Joe!
No one is half the battle.
I mean, they also had, I grew up on She-Ra, and they had at the end of every episode, what was that little sprightly figure that would teach you lessons from the episode?
That wasn't Snarf?
Snarf, that's correct.
And He-Man had those as well, and he would get a little, his version with Orko.
All right. Welcome, David and John and Alicia. We are covering Dune 2021 today, but this is somewhat fluid. A few of us are book readers. Steve and I are both not, but am I right to say that, Steve? You're not a Dune book reader?
No.
What about you, John?
I have never interacted with Dune beyond a couple pages where I went, not right now, until last night when I watched the movie.
Oh, all right. Oh, so you just saw the movie for the first time last night?
I did.
Wow. Okay.
We're having an exciting time.
And then, David, what is your relationship with Dune?
I've read the core six books probably maybe six or seven times. I've seen the 84 movie more times than I can count. And I've watched the 21 movie maybe four times now, I think.
Okay. Four or five times. All right. And Alicia, if I understand correctly, you will be launching a Dune book podcast shortly, right?
Yes, starting in August, basically. We're going to be looking at the first book, Dune, and then no fewer than four adaptations of it. So sort of just looking at how each adaptation has tackled the story differently, and trying to learn from it, you know, what makes a good adaptation in addition to, you know, just diving deep into the world of Dune and all of the politics and sci-fi world building and fun stuff.
And how can people find that podcast?
Yeah, so that's going to be the second season of Wool Shift Dust. The first season was dedicated to the TV show Silo. And in between seasons, we're going to keep busy with this for a little while.
Fantastic. So Wool Shift Dust. And I suppose I should mention that together with the Lorehounds, we're all part of the Barovian Broadcast Network. Did I say that right?
That is right.
All right. I don't know why that's a tough one for me. All right, let's go ahead and jump into Dune here. So, Steve, this is a question for you. I will give you all of the dime bags of spice that you could ever want. But for every dime bag, you get a face boil.
Ugh. This is just an anti-meth campaign, right?
I don't know, man. The spice rules the universe.
Have you been to Lake County up here in California? Because it's not that different.
Alicia, my understanding is that the spice in Amsterdam is a bit more expensive, but totally worth it.
I think in the U.S., to be honest, you have access to more stuff at better qualities and more variety these days, you know, because it's actually more officially legal there than it is here.
And we do have more desert scape, I suppose. But
having just watched the 1984 one, I feel like I'd prefer Old Spice. It also helps you appreciate the music of Toto much better, I found out.
Why Toto when Sting is right there?
I wonder if that like the whole time just bothered him.
I think that would have been a little bit too on the nose.
Yeah, what if he just like burst into song in the middle of the film? That would have been the only thing that could have possibly made a good film better.
Watching that, there were plenty of moments where I actually thought it would like it behaves like it's a musical porno in many ways, but it delivers none of the music or the pornography. It's like, so like the way that it's filmed and like what I think is going to happen next is like, this would be a really good time for someone to break into song or, you know, full money shot. Like it was just like, it was crazy. Like I felt teased by the 84 version.
Well, maybe you're misunderstanding what the worms represent then, Steve.
Okay. So it's a very thinly veiled metaphor.
Right. They're blessing the rains down in Arrakis. Right?
I mean, if you're going to give Spider-Man or Captain America a musical on Broadway, you might as well give Dune a shot, right? What could go wrong?
Why not?
I love it.
I'll tell you what can go wrong. Pronoun city can go wrong. I have never heard so many strings of proper nouns in my life in a 2 hour span. But I guess I'll rant about that later.
Now, John, have you recently watched 84 Dune?
No, I have not.
Okay.
So I will be the virgin ears, the virgin eyes, I guess.
All right. We need to add that to our old man movies list, John. That is a classic that you must watch someday. I make John watch movies as part of our Patreon exclusive podcast.
Nice. Yeah, and I was thinking about it being a good pick for it.
So, David, let's stay with you. Tell me about why this movie was your choice.
When you messaged us about, you know, the upcoming season for Properly Howard and you pitched the concept for remakes and, you know, and then invited us to come on, I dropped everything that I was doing in that moment. I just went straight to Wikipedia and I was like, okay, movie remakes, like, where's the list? And mm-hmm. I started combing through the list and making my things. And then I saw that Dune was, you know, eligible as it were. And then as we were whittling down the things, I think you messaged me to say that was an option because of, you know, obviously a natural tie-in for Dune Part 2, the Villeneuve movie coming out. And so right. It just seemed to be the natural choice.
But in addition to that, you've read the series 6 times. So,
yes.
And I'm assuming you've watched the 84 Dune before this week.
Love it. Yeah, I watched it. I was watching it on double speed, which is pretty fun. To watch the Baron Harkonnen bouncing around in his little bubble suit throughout the set. I did. And I was trying to catch up on the Yodorowsky documentary before we started, but I ran out of time.
So with this most recent movie, what do you feel like it got right? Like, was there an aspect of the movie that you thought, oh, finally, they did this the way that I had always envisioned it, or wow, I can't believe they pulled that off.
I have problems with the most recent movie, but I also have a lot that I like. Alicia and I were going back and forth on Twitter earlier today about what certain things that we didn't like. What I did like, the ornithopters look great.
Awesome.
The shield looks great, and the scale. I think if you were going to force me to pick one thing, scale. They got scale right. The ships, the worms, the how big a planet really is relative to space, how big the guild highliners are. All of that really feels deserved of this story, the bigness of it, the enormity, I'm a mere mortal, tiny little human being, and I cannot comprehend the size of a guild highliner. Mm-hmm. And I felt that in this movie.
What are the sort of the pyramid palace? What's that
in
place
Arrakeen?
Called? Yeah.
On the Dune planet. I think it's just the palace. Alicia may.
I would just say the palace as well.
Okay. I was just going to say, even when they're inside the palace, it just feels like that place was built for giants.
Right.
You know, they, I mean, even the scale of the interior of the place is just breathtaking.
But yeah, but it was like a Harkonnen building, and you can see that they just want to intimidate everyone around them constantly. So, you know, you put somebody in that vast space and make them feel very small.
Right.
You give some space to float around too, which is nice. I think that's important.
So, John, this was your first viewing. What was your takeaways of this movie?
Well, one thing I really liked was the voice and how they portrayed that. It felt very unsettling and invasive. And I almost felt like it really portrayed to me how the character was feeling. And something that is mind control is something that's so hard to portray on screen, right? It's something that I think books have the advantage of, because you can get that inner monologue. But this was a really excellent portrayal of something that just felt like violative. Set up three. And of course, just the whole way that they present this chosen one idea that is not quite the traditional chosen one, but is instead sort of a twist on it and is sort of a subversion of it. You know, is he really the chosen one because his mother subverted the prophecy and whatnot? I'm a sucker for a good subversion of the chosen one trope. That is like one of my favorite tropes. The Mistborn trilogy with Brandon Sanderson, sort of the Wheel of Time plays with it a little bit. Like just that is one of my favorite things in any kind of fantasy.
All right, let's jump in there, because I feel like there were so many stories when I was growing up that was sort of playing with some kind of messianic figure. And it was over and over and over again. And I just felt like, man, this is done to death. And then
you also grew up in the church.
Well, absolutely.
I mean, they kind of do that to death.
You had the traditional one. Huh? Year.
Oh, here we go again. Unto us a child is born.
So there's something about sort of rehashing that old mythology that just feels like, can this work anymore? Because I kind of feel like this is just, I feel like the last movie that I saw that where it actually worked was The Matrix. And when The Matrix did it, I thought, oh, well, that's the way you do it. That's kind of, how could anyone top that? And well, I didn't have a lot of exposure to Dune growing up, but it felt like every other movie, every other book that I was messing with messianic typology in some way. I don't know. I just kind of feel like it's a little bit risky to try to make that work with modern film. David, you were going to say?
No, let Alicia go, because both her and I are biting our thumbs right now because we have so much to say.
we talked about, you know, saving things for the end that might be spoilers from future books, and maybe this is, but let's just say that the series as a whole, especially like the books, like what we'll see play out in the third part of this Villeneuve trilogy, is it's all about, yeah, what is it mean to be this messianic figure, and what does it cost? What is it? Biting
it's
my
not
tongue.
A, it's I, not a fairy princess story. No. Ultimately, it's
can't
it's,
spell messianic without messy, guys. It's just the way it works.
That's exactly right.
But it's just also the question of like why he's perceived this way in general and in the first place, and has he bought into his own bullshit? Sorry, am I allowed to curse on this podcast?
You just did. You ruined it.
That's right.
You opened up a can. Now
you can bleep me.
If I know John, it's all going to go downhill from here. No, I feel like... I was just going to say, and I'll let you finish for sure. Yeah. I feel like in this film, I was totally invested. And I wasn't like rolling my eyes thinking, oh, geez, they're going to do this again. So like I'm hooked. Like I'm kind of just fascinated to see what they do with the trope. But I'm sorry. Go ahead, Alicia.
No, I was just going to ask David how he was going to dance around that topic.
Yeah, I think I have to go back to one of the things that they did wrong in this film. And the thing that they didn't, this part of the story that they couldn't tell or didn't tell, the choices that they made was that Paul was being trained as a mentat. Paul was being right. trained as a you know, top class combatant fighter. You know, he had the best fighting master instructor in the galaxy, who is leading a army, who is the head of an army. This is Duncan Idaho I'm talking about. Or Gurney Halleck, sorry. Well, Duncan and Gurney. Anyway, that the Atreides are building a fighting force that will rival the Sadukar. And so Paul is being taught the top of the art of this army. Mm. And at the same time, he's being taught all of the Bene Gesserit secrets by his mother. And so when he gets, is that there's the Missionaria Protectiva, which the Bene Gesserit went out into the universe and seeded mythology throughout the universe such that if one of their people or their plans ever, somebody needed an out or an escape, there was a mythology that you could tap into and use that as your escape route or, you know, as your way to gain control of a situation on a planet. So this was done thousands of years ago where all of these myths were embedded in all these cultures and language and planets. So there's this weird coming together of Paul's training and all of the, and the bloodline that he's representing. And then this political trick that the Bene Gesserit set up. And so these two things sort of come together. And so there's a deeper level, which I couldn't get into at all in the movie.
Yeah.
Do you feel that was better represented in the 84 version?
It was, I don't think it's, Alicia, I don't think, in my opinion, it's not represented in.
I mean, movie. I went back and I've watched the 84 version just the other day, you know, in preparation for this. And I had, I realized I'd sort of like romanticized, like imagining like scenes that were cut from the 21 version versus the book. I had sort of thought like, oh, well, they're in the 84 version. I'm like, no, they're not. You know what is actually the most complete version is the sci-fi version from 2000.
All the miniseries.
Yeah. I mean, it's cheesy production effects, but it's actually, it's in some ways it's, you know, it's one of the best in terms of being able to tell more layers like this of the story.
I have a question about that since you've raised the idea of a series. Mm-hmm. Why is this a movie? Because right. It felt to me when I was watching it that there was a lot thrown at me that I would have much more easily digested and much more easily gotten into if it were a season of a TV show.
Agreed.
I think a lot of people have that same thought, John. I don't think you're alone.
Is it a rights thing? Like I legitimately am asking.
So let me just go ahead and push back a little bit here. I feel like watching this film in an IMAX theater with the scale that you mentioned before was one of the best movie going experiences of my life.
Wow.
The sound, like I just felt like, and it could have been like I was cooped up with COVID for, you know, a good 2 years or something. So I was sort of ready to get back in the theater, but just the beauty of this film, it just looks amazing. Like I said, the sound, the scale of it, I'm so glad it was on the big screen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I also think that there's two things at play here, right? Two things are equally true. My experience, my introduction to Dune outside of just it being sort of an inside joke on SNL back in 84 and all that stuff was this film, right? So I don't have a comparison. I don't have something to say they didn't do this, they didn't do that. Oh, they undercut this part because I don't have a frame of reference really. But listening to you know what David's talking about, like there's an interesting dichotomy between you know, the different world, like, especially if you look at the militaristic side and maybe the more spiritual side that Paul's going through, that doesn't get really captured. And that's an interesting thing to me that I just, you know, would it be better? Would I have had a better time in the movie with that? Maybe. But I'm certainly obviously missing some of the nuance of the original work.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to do. Villeneuve had to make a movie that you could see without reading the books and understand right. it. And we talked, John and I talked about that a lot with our Rings of Power coverage, is what choices do you have to make to hit your central themes but still be able to watch something that is watchable? I think what John was pointing at with why isn't this a series is one of the questions to ask, even though the scale of it does fit IMAX or, you know, large screen performance.
Is it directorial hubris maybe that says they feel that this is a film that cannot, or this is a book that cannot be filmed on, and oh, I'll show them.
Wow. Yeah, it's probably, there's a bit of that. I was the first thing I wrote down when I was watching the 21 version was that the first minute of this film, maybe just even the first 30 seconds of this film, sort of a masterclass in world building. Whereas the 84 film, it was like, oh, geez, what a
exposition.
What is happening here?
Virginia Madsen every once in a while fading back into the stars as she continues to talk. And then we get a space hemorrhoid.
So I don't know. That's sort of my answer, John. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's time we all just admit that a lot of us would pay money to go see premieres of TV shows in the theaters. That's and true. If movie theaters want to stay open, maybe they should just let people watch HBO on Sunday night in a theater.
That'd be interesting.
Maybe that's the answer, right?
If I could get a drink and something to eat, I would.
Yeah, right? Like, that sounds like a great experience. I would watch a 10-episode Dune series every Sunday. Like, that sounds like a great, you know, entertainment thing.
Could you imagine Succession on a big screen like that? Oh. Or Last of Us?
What a time. What a time. We can dream.
All right. Look. I gotta reel us in here. There are certain movies you just want to see on a big screen.
Sure.
I mean, there are movies that I feel like, yeah, fine. I'll watch Asteroid City on a little screen. I don't mind that.
But I think Wes Anderson would be furious, you know, hearing that, but yes.
It is the kind of movie that, like, I probably would enjoy just as much. But this is the kind of movie that I kind of feel like you're robbing yourself of some kind of important experience not to see it in a theater with people on the big screen. But anyway, I'll get off.
No, I mean, that's fair. I mean, I watched it on a TV. I didn't see it in a theater. So I don't know. I don't know what this looked like in IMAX.
All right. Let me ask everyone if there's one tweak that you could make. David, you've already touched on something that you didn't think that they did right. But if there was, yeah, absolutely. If there was a tweak that you could make that you think would improve Dune Part One,
the diction,
what would it be?
I absolutely hated the speech of the characters in this. They sounded like I was at my local grocery store talking to my neighbor about the weather. This is a noble house. This is a house that's so powerful that it's challenging the power of the emperor and the emperor's death troopers. And they're set into this trap that they can't get out. The family line goes all the way back. Alicia, remind me, is it Agamemnon? Or
yeah, it is Agamemnon.
Agamemnon goes all the way back to Earth and the Greek, you know. And they talk like, I just met my buddy down at the 7-Eleven. It drove me mad. It really, I wanted to scream and shout and light my non-existent hair on fire.
I just think that, I don't know if you've noticed, we as a people, we're dumber lately. Give it another 8,000 years. I'm actually impressed that we're able to speak at all.
Alicia, what about you? What would week.
Yeah, well, I know this is another one that I know David agrees with me on, and it's the characterization of Jessica. So I think the casting is perfect. Rebecca Ferguson is a fantastic Lady Jessica, but she's a Bene Gesserit, and she should not be freaking weeping all the time. Like, every time we see her, she's crying, and this is supposed to be a stoic person. Now, I understand they're doing it because you know, in the book, you get to see inside her head, and you get to see she is in turmoil, even though she doesn't show it to people. So there has to be a way to show it on screen, but I just think they could have done it through conversation with the people closest to her in life. So that's my tweak.
One of the weirdest things about the original movie, or the 84 movie, is the amount that they overlay their whispered thoughts. Like, I feel like everything is either like, either people are screaming or whispering in that film.
The drama.
And there's some of the funniest lines. There's some of the funniest, but it was like, I'd rather, against my better instincts, I'd rather like this Duke or whatever it was. I just loved that one quite a bit.
Well, one of my favorite scenes is when Patrick Stewart charges into battle with a bulldog and a baby Bjorn.
And what's with the bulldogs?
Were there bulldogs in the book?
No, I don't think that was a detail that we got covered in.
But I was distracted on this rewatch, just wondering, like, what happened to the dogs?
All right, Steve, a tweak that you would make to improve.
Well, I think I should also mention this, since this is my first time watching it, and I liked it, right? And I was kind of on edge, because I'm like, it sounds to me like Dune is a very complicated and maybe a world I'm not really all that interested in. I did like what I saw, right? So on one hand, you go, okay, well, maybe this was a Dune movie for non-Dune lovers in some ways, right? Like, this is Diet Dune, right? And
new Dune.
Yeah, and so, and I Mountain Dune, and I liked we could do it all day. And so I liked it. So, and but I do think, you know, it's kind of hard to know now that I think I'm a little bit clouded by, like, kind of listening to what you were talking about and doing a little bit of research for this podcast. There were elements that I think I would have wanted to see a little bit more, like maybe a little bit more on the Emperor, you know, because like the Emperor's sort of concept is sort of, it's suggested, but it sounded like, you know, at least from the 84 version, when the aforementioned space hemorrhoid comes in and they have their dialogue, like there's a little bit more to it. And I guess maybe I like a little more of the political intrigue behind it, like maybe what's also pushing this and what's, you know, how are the dominoes falling? So maybe that would have been it. But again, I think you run into so many risks, and maybe some things will be more revealed as you get into the next films. But
so you're asking for more exposition, Steve?
Not exposition, like more, just give me more things, right? I mean, like there's a background, there's an element of, like, so the David Lynch 84 version, I mean, there were plenty of opportunities to show and not tell, but it really leaned heavily into tell. But like, I would have liked to have known a little bit more, or seen a little bit more of the other worlds kind of behind it. Like, because while the scale was big, the universe didn't feel as big as I think maybe the novels have created it to be.
I think in one of the things that they got wrong is they waited to greenlight part two until they saw the box office numbers. And I felt that did a massive disservice for everyone who has not read or seen, or, you know, not partaken in the Dune prior, because you then stop on this cliffhanger and you're not vested and you're not interested. And you're like, well, I don't know. Am I ever going to get to see the completion of this? Why would I bother? And I think if you had known, hey, this is a trilogy and we're going to get all of this, you're going to get all this stuff, then I think you can hang out and and suspend questions, that you have your questions, but then not be driven by them in the same way.
Yeah, when my wife and I watched this, I think she may have seen the original Dune, just who knows why. And so she was also kind of like, oh, well, let's give it a shot. And we both really liked it, and we were both in the same exact spot, which was, man, I sure hope this does well enough to get another one, because I did feel invested, but I also was invested in the sense that I know that there's more that I want to find out, and hopefully that gets revealed, right? And so in some ways, maybe, and you know, maybe there'll be a little bit more nuance even in another film, because now that it's been greenlit, you can kind of explore the space, for lack of a better term, a little bit more, maybe, because you've been given permission.
Alicia, how do you know how far they're going to go with the trilogy? Are they going to go into the Dune Messiah book?
Yeah, so the third movie is going to be based on Dune Messiah.
Okay.
Yeah, I say, do God Emperor Dune, you cowards.
But we're going to get a complete Paul Atreides story.
Yes, basically. Right? Yeah,
that's we're gonna get the going whole for. Thing. Okay, mm-hmm. Good. So yeah, that necessitates conversations and storytelling on these more complex and deeper levels. So,
right. So then they're going to get into all of these different complicated layers about the Bene Gesserit and what it means to be a Messiah. And, yeah.
Okay, John, what about you? If there was a tweak you could make that you think that would improve this movie?
You know, I've read a lot of fantasy. I've watched a lot of fantasy. I've consumed a lot of fantasy and sci-fi. And I like to think I can handle a lot of word salad, a lot of proper nouns. I can say Nirnaeth Arnoniad. I can say Teleron Riod. But I cannot keep track of all of these proper nouns. Mm. And they needed to slow it down, because I was like, he's a what? He's a Benedict Cumberbatch. He's supposed to be the Quasimodo. Like, I don't know what you're saying in these words. And I've always thought of myself as someone who has not been defeated by a piece of like a set of proper nouns in some fantasy sci-fi world. And this did it. This broke me. Wow. At a certain point, I had to say to myself, I am not going to remember all these names, and I'm going in for vibes. And that's okay. Like, I still got the vibe. I still understood he's got magic powers. He's basically a messiah. Okay, whatever. But like, boy, oh boy, did this like make my eyes glaze over sometimes.
This is exactly the trouble that anyone who tries to make a film like this faces, that's based on sort of a beloved book, especially of this kind of story. You're absolutely going to bifurcate the audience. You're going to get people to feel like, I wish it was closer to book content. I would have liked it better if they would have just kept to the original story. And then there are people like us who haven't read the books, who just wanted the storytelling to be clearer and more simple. And I don't know. I feel like you really can't win with that kind of thing. Maybe this is a problem with the original book and not necessarily a problem with this particular movie. I didn't trip on this.
But you can see
I had a hard time.
Why some of the choices they made in the 84 movie, they did. The exposition, the voiceover, inner monologue stuff. There are technologies in the 84 movie that have no place in the books at all, but they use them to bridge concept and move plot to explain why the House Atreides is so powerful. Oh, well, they have these weirding modules. That's
just going to say one of my favorite things, weirding modules.
Yes.
So that's actually the biggest beef that I have with David Lynch about this film is he said that he used the weirding modules because he didn't want to do some sort of like sand kung fu. I'm like, sand kung fu sounds like so awesome. It should be the title of a movie on its own. Like, what are you talking about?
Just for anybody who hasn't, John, and anybody else who hasn't seen the 84 movie, the Atreides forces have this device that they can attach to their throat, and then they can focus their sound, and they have a little handheld unit that can then shoot sound lasers, basically. And it was a device to show how dangerous they were relative to the Emperor's forces. Mm. And it was really hard to explain how the Atreides are dangerous. It has to do with loyalty. It has to do with training. It has to do with esprit de corps, a whole bunch of stuff. And so they just boiled it down into, they have this super weapon. And it's fine that they did it in the 84 movie, but it's also fine that they didn't do it in the 21 movie. It shouldn't have been in the 21 movie.
Unless they would have used the phrase, let's get weird, and then they unleash it. That would have been amazing.
So, Alicia, I want to ask, for folks who just saw this for the first time and they need a little bit of help, I just thought maybe some very basic plot points that you could help us with. Would you be able to help us with who the Atreides are, who the Harkonnens are, and what the Empire is, and what is the relationship between these sort of major
So think brokers. Of it like a triangle, basically, where, you know, the Emperor ostensibly is and wants to be the one in control. But then at the same time, you have these very two powerful houses, the Atreides and the Harkonnens. And so he kind of basically pits them against each other because he's worried that particularly the Atreides army is getting too good and could beat his own. So he just, you know, thinks if my enemies weaken each other, then that makes me stronger.
So there's a suggestion in this film that that Arrakis, the Dune planet, has been sort of sent to the Atreides to be stewards, but it's sort of like it's a curse disguised as a blessing. Like there's, it looks like a gift, but maybe it's sort of it's meant to bring about the ruin or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's this whole pitting against each other thing, because he took it from the Harkonnens to give to the Atreides. And he knows that there's going to be war over the spice. It's sort of inevitable. So they're putting them in a position where, and setting them up so that the Atreides can be, you know, wiped out, so that, he can be more powerful.
And should I think of the Emperor as sort of like a Palpatine kind of figure who's almost all powerful?
No. Well, I mean, I think if he were, I think that a lot of his motivation is that he's not as powerful as he wants to be, you know? And so I wouldn't say, and it's not, you know, it's not that he's completely, like, the Harkonnens are more mustache twirly than the Emperor. Wouldn't you say, David?
Absolutely. And I think it's, if we frame this as a feudal society, then you can, and the Landsraad, which is sort of the gathering of the noble houses into some sort of quorum, some sort of deliberative body. The Emperor is playing his enemies against each other, like Alicia said, to weaken. He wins no matter what. The Emperor wins no matter what.
Right. So there's more at stake in having these two houses go to war than there is to, like, cease spice production, I guess. Because I think that on the surface, you kind of think, well, if spice is sort of the...
Think of spice as oil.
Most important aspect.
Okay.
Well, I know, but the Emperor seems to be willing to punt on spice production in order to get this war going.
They stockpiled.
Right.
Okay.
Right. He knew he was setting That's up. Helpful. So it's a long, you know, there's a longer game. So it cost them, but yeah, they were planning this for a while.
Exactly. Very much a game of space chess.
Was there a trope, a cliche, or a device that you enjoyed in this film? Steve, let's start with you.
I think Jason Momoa. He's a cliche that I'm okay with.
You actually stole mine. I was going to say, give me a guy who's decided that I'm going to give my life in a sort of a, almost a suicide effort to fight 20 men to save, you know, save the day.
No! Duncan, no!
He's locked the door.
No!
Momoa was sort of like was built for that scene.
Nothing beats the close the door. No, no. Every time.
And that's right. Actually a change from the right. Book. So I don't mind that change, because in the book, he just kind of dies off page.
It's a bummer.
Wah, wah.
All right, David, what about you? A device, a trope, or a cliche that you enjoyed?
I think the dream sequence-y stuff, as the heroes on their journey, and their visions are coming closer and closer to matching up to the reality of the moment. So, you know, he's been dreaming a lot about Chani, and then he finally meets Chani. So I thought that they did that good, and they used the dreams in some interesting ways too. There's some other, for book readers, there's some other cool stuff going on there, but I thought the whole dream device worked well.
Yeah. I wish Zendaya would have had more of a role earlier, and I don't know how to do that with this film, but I guess is the problem. Part of the problem with doing a part
doing a part one without telling us that a part two is coming.
Right. Mm-hmm. That was a big one.
Yeah. Right.
But I like
that plot device didn't work.
Yeah, I guess I would have just.
But I like that they made it was Zendaya's Chani who is the one who opened with the narration instead of Princess Irulan, which is what happens in the 84 film in the books. So,
yeah. Alicia, let's stay with you. A device, a trope, or a cliche that you enjoyed.
Yeah, okay. Well, sticking with Chani, I would say just the way they did the Fremen, you know, the whole desert people trope. This is obviously also from the story that invented it, but this is the adaptation that did it the best, where you just really believe that these are people who are relaxed in this setting. This is their home. And yeah, they nailed it. I believe these people could ride worms.
And relaxed with death and life and fighting. Yeah.
So I love it. I love it when two cultures are interacting for the first time and there's some kind of custom that seems like an insult to one of the cultures.
Right.
But it's sort of like a gesture of respect by the other culture. I thought the table spitting scene was really
good. That's a great pick. A really good pick.
I thought you were just talking about this podcast.
Steve, is this film better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film?
I'm gonna give it a Howard plus two, probably because of scale and overall just how consistent I felt with the tone. And the 84 one is a Howard minus 11.
No.
Which means I will watch that probably a bunch. Because now that I saw that today, I was like, why have I not watched this a ton? Are you kidding me right now? This is insane. Just the Toto alone, I'm in.
Have some gummies and watch.
It's oh, good. Baby, you better believe it.
David, better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film?
How does the scale for the plus or minus just go as far as you want?
Or basically, this is just for you to say whatever you want. There's no logic.
This is the backbone of our podcast, and it means nothing.
How did you feel when you left this film?
I would say that it's a Howard plus 1.5, somewhere right in there. I had a lot of problems, but I have a lot of problems with a lot of Howard films. So, yeah, I think it was better than the average Ron Howard film.
What about you, John?
I'm gonna come in. I'm gonna say it's properly Howard. It's about a Ron Howard film. You know, it's got its good moments. It's got its bad moments. It entertains me, and then it doesn't.
Alicia.
I'm going to give it an anti-Howard because it's basically like the antithesis of what a Ron Howard film is. It's, you know, Ron Howard films like heart and quirk and gumption. And this is not that.
All right. I like it. I like that you subverted the scale. I am going to stick with the scale. I'm going to say Howard plus six.
Whoa.
I loved this film. I've watched it three times, maybe four times.
Wow.
It just breathtaking to me. I feel like I finally get Dune. I finally get, now I want to go read the books. So this is sort of my entry point into, a mythology that I knew that I would probably like, but I never really took the time to get to know it. So I love this film. Loved it a lot.
Yeah, I'm going to jump into there. Yeah, so this was only the second time I'd watched this one. And my schedule's been kind of wonky. So I ended up watching it like till like 1:30 in the morning last night. And I was like, you know, when you watch something the second time, the first time you see it, it's sort of the same thing as you, Anthony. It's like, okay, I'm kind of giving this a shot. Let's go. And I was taken by it. So I was kind of a little bit anxious to see it again, to think like, I wonder if it's going to be too much of like, sort of what would like some of John's critiques, like, cause I do remember that part, but I was so enamored with the rest of it. And, but I thought it was great. I loved the ride the whole way through. The scale is fantastic. I understood the story as well as I probably could. And then, which I was also a little bit nervous, like, well, maybe I just really liked what I was looking at, but no, I ended up really liking the films.
Yeah. There was a couple of visual sequences in this film that just took my breath away. And one of them was when Baron Harkonnen levitates for the first time. To me, that was just, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. And then what do you call those devices that will lift up the spice harvesters?
Carryall.
Yeah, the carryall. For the first time, you saw those sort of ballooned vertical blimps that extended above. I love that.
That's a show. And, I mean, there are carryalls in the harvesters, and then the balloon lifting thing, that's a movie invention, because he never really explains it in the books, as far as I can recall.
Okay.
So it's I agree. I think it's a brilliant adaptation. It's so visually striking.
Production design is perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. I feel like I've been swimming in CGI soup for the last 20 years. So for anything to kind of really show me something special, it was a revelatory experience. I felt like I had not seen this aesthetic.
I spent a lot of time trying to pick apart the effects. Because, like, you know, you watch things and you watch them at a time and you go, it'll never get better than this. And then, you know, then Ghostbusters 2 comes out. And wow, that was, yeah. And, but then, you know, you just move on to the next. And, but so this was like one of those, I'm like, all right, like, you know, we're in a pretty golden age of effects, obviously. And, but it's like, I was just kept on picking things apart and I was like, this is really great. I mean, I feel like I'm somewhere else.
All right. So just focused on this first part. So we don't have the entire series in mind. Is there a half the battle, one to grow on moment? Let's start with you, David.
Don't ever make a bargain with the mustache twirling bad guy and think that they're going to actually deliver what they promise to you. So Dr. Yui, sorry, dude, take a lesson. don't believe the Baron.
Alicia?
Yeah, I would say, you know, if you're offered to take over the stronghold of your greatest enemy after your concubine gave you a son instead of a daughter, they're supposed to marry their son. Say no. Just a basic everyday life lesson we all need to hear.
Mm. John, half the battle, one to grow on moment.
If you are choosing a name for your son who's supposed to be the messiah of a great sci-fi fantasy family, it's not Paul.
You had trouble with all the names. That was the one common name.
But that's the problem, is there's so much dissonance between that name and every other name in this thing.
I don't know. Like, Duncan Idaho was Leto, pretty
Paul.
Duncan Idaho. Fantastic. Steve, you got a half the battle, one to grow on.
Hey, spice in moderation, kids.
Little bit to relax. Don't overdo it.
Exactly. You know, like I said, maybe get the CBD spice, right? Just a little something to take the edge off.
Well, this has been a delightful conversation. I feel like I just love this movie, and I feel like I feel like I could really benefit from a read through the books and maybe an accompanying podcast. So, Alicia, I will be tuning into Wool Shift Dust for sure.
Great. Excellent. Yeah. Look for a preview episode to drop at the end of July, like last day of July, I think.
Fantastic. And David and John, what are you guys up to with the Lorehounds?
We are about to start full coverage of Foundation.
Fantastic.
I think by the time this drops, it will be running full in on that. So
I just realized that that's exactly why I couldn't handle the proper nouns, is that I've been watching Foundation at the same time.
Oh,
right.
That'll break.
And I can't take that many in at the same time. There's a conveyor belt, you know, there's a limit.
And then I think after that, we've got Ahsoka. which I think John is, I'm guessing, John and I haven't talked since the trailer just dropped.
I'm hype.
Yeah, I figured.
Okay. All right. All right.
And Wheel of Time.
Steve, next week we're doing RoboCop.
Oh, baby.
So I'm looking forward. I think I might have seen a few scenes from the RoboCop remake, but I just watched the original RoboCop for the first time.
Which is insane to me. It's insane to me that this is your first time watching RoboCop.
You can't call yourself a Gen Xer, Anthony.
I have a few blind spots. There was something about that grotesque head protruding from that machine body. It's too much to take, man. It's too much.
But did you watch movies like Alien and Predator growing up?
No, never watched any of them.
Okay. All right.
I was not into the scary movie stuff, but I have been in more recent years. And of course, Steve has helped me.
Yeah,
has been my guide through
the education of Dr. LaDon. It's been fun.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Is this a Pygmalion? Is this a remake?
Horror.